great to have such a great turnout. We probably have a lot of new attendees here. I'm curious to know more where about you're all coming from. Where are you? Can someone give me an idea of what your background is, whether you're an economist, a planner, a policy person? Just shout out some things, but how you would characterize yourself.
Banker.
Social work.
Real estate developer.
Public transit advocate.
Wow, this is great. It's great to have lots of different perspectives.
Old age.
We welcome that perspective, too. So it's great to have Dr. Barbara Brown-Wilson here. We shared some time at the University of Texas, and it was always a joy to spend time with her. And so it's quite a privilege for her to be here. It's generous for her to come to Pittsburgh in the middle of winter. Unfortunately, she missed a warm trend just by a few days. Dr. Brown-Wilson is an assistant professor of urban and environmental planning in the School of Architecture at the University of Virginia. Her research and teaching focus is on ethics theory and the practice of sustainable community development and design. She's interested in the history of urban social movements. Her research is often change-oriented in that she collaborates with real community partners to identify opportunities for engaged and integrated sustainable development. Current projects include understanding the actor networks, reframing urban infrastructure in more climate and culturally appropriate ways. She is the co-founder of the Design Futures Student Leadership Forum, a student leadership training that includes a consortium of 15 universities and practitioners working to elevate the educational realms of community-engaged design. She also co-founded the Austin Community Design and Development Center, a nonprofit design center that provides high-quality green design and planning services to lower-income households and organizations. With pleasure, I introduce Dr. Barbara Brown-Wilson.
Okay, are we ready for me?
Yeah.
Sure. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me. As Dr. Blockhoff said, we spent some time together as colleagues at the University of Texas at Austin, and so I thought it would be kind of fun to actually focus on some of the work that I've done that came out of that collaboration, partially because I've already asked that maybe there will be times where we can jump in and talk about things from his perspective. I love that there are people from practice and different, you know, sort of age ranges and also sort of different disciplinary perspectives in the room right now, and I'm excited. This is work that I think probably all of you could actually contribute to and all learn from, so I hope that we can have a nice conversation. And just so you know, I will be probably tasking Dr. Blackhurst at some point to contribute his knowledge, because I think it's really part of what's interesting about this type of focus. So this project in particular was, as the title sort of alludes, was this interest in trying to think a bit more strategically about how cities might align these different infrastructure systems, so the sort of social, political, technical, built infrastructure systems that relate to housing, especially affordable housing, that relate to transit use and transit systems, and the sort of development that comes around them, and that relate to the sort of green building world. In this case, especially trying to understand the role of preserving the embodied energy that is, worth saving in things that are already built, right? So trying to understand how these things align with one another, where they come into conflict, and how groups can sort of better work together to shared ends. In particular, I think this arose partially out of an understanding that there are many pushes in cities across the country right now to further, cities are incentivizing the development of transit-oriented development that is new, where, you know, you maybe take down the old things and build up something new that's green, and it's creates walkable communities, and everybody's healthy, right, and we have, like, a good, flourishing transit system. But often the sort of majority of transit riders are actually lower income people of color, whom are, you know, in the unsubsidized affordable housing that it was already built on these transit corridors. So, you know, in the, just to be clear, some of you, I'm sure, sort of get the unsubsidized affordable housing language, but naturally occurring, right? So affordable housing that doesn't have any direct subsidy or intervention associated with it and is mostly typically affordable because it's older housing stock and, you know, sort of, this is important mostly because unsubsidized affordable housing is also the major way that lower income people are housed. It's like 80% of the sort of lower income community is actually housed in unsubsidized affordable housing. Of course, sometimes you have other incomes that are housed in unsubsidized affordable housing as well, but it is the next best option to direct subsidy, which is, you know, really limited in terms of the, you know, the sort of amount of housing. And of course, if you want a healthy transit system, you'd like your riders to be near the stops, right? So there's just some really kind of mutually beneficial synergies potentially there, but in, especially in strong markets, but really in any economy in which, you know, the sort of tax base is the driving force, it's difficult to think through how we might actively perpetuate the preservation of unsubsidized affordable housing along transit corridors, right? Mostly because the housers don't talk to the transit people, and the transit people don't, you know, as in this interdisciplinary setting, you're probably well aware, there's just a lot of language barriers, you know, just really getting on the same page about what any of these words mean and why they're important is a tremendous challenge all on its own. So in Austin at the time, there was a bit of a crisis moment. This is a really strong moment in Austin's market that's growing, you know, at a really ridiculous rate. And there is a real thriving community of unsubsidized affordable housing. So you can't really see this here, but the green, these are all unsubsidized affordable housing units along multifamily, along transit corridors. The green are actually under 50 units in a building, and the purple are, you know, sort of 25 or less. So these are kind of mid-rise in scale, and really, really important to the city of Austin if it wants to be a place that's not kind of sprawling and actually inclusive of lots of different types of communities and having a stronger ridership, which is a huge issue in a city like that. So our colleague Liz Mueller actually sort of developed this approach and brought Mike and I on to think through not only sort of the energy flows and the sort of different policy implications around those, but also, in my case, the programmatic associations that were working in other parts of the country. The city of Austin actually started to care about this because one particular development in the Riverside corridor, so down here, was up for redevelopment. The city had really sort of lured the developer who was taking down old and building up new. But there was also a really thriving immigrant community that got organized and sort of acknowledged their own displacement and asked for some sort of assistance in getting proper relocation. They mostly were, true public transit riders, and so wanted to stay in the, in the central parts of the city that were connected to said transit system, and there weren't many options because it's this really strong marketplace available to them at the rates they can afford. So most of them were moved to Woodridge, which almost immediately became actually in a state of official disaster because the handrails started falling off and the buildings themselves were really kind of like breaking apart. And this is where, most of the city had just sent these people. So there's a sort of recognition that there is a real lack of high quality, healthy, unsubsidized affordable housing and the infrastructure in place to preserve it in a strong market economy. So my task in this sort of interdisciplinary team was to look at cities that had done this relatively well, or at least formed some sort of approach to trying to strategically align the systems of, you know, affordable housing, of transit, you know, sort of advocacy, and of green building or retrofitting strategies. So, you know, how are they approaching this? What are the different actors in place? And there's a real acknowledgement here, right, that the built world actually is an actor. There are market forces at play that are sort of actors as well. So there's a real sort of non-human actor component to these programs that kind of has to be acknowledged if we're going to think about replicability and how this might work in other places. In what ways are the residents, the tenants themselves, involved? There's, of course, a wide range of approaches here. And then what retrofitting strategies are really successful? And it became clear early on to me that actually actor network theory might be a really useful lens for this work, partially because we have so many, actors trying to formulate connections with one another and understand their associations, and that the role and the agency that some of these non-human actors actually had in the process was pretty powerful. And so trying to understand these associations, actor network theory also sort of creates a space for the city to not necessarily be whole or fragmented, and instead sort of be fluid, and there to be, you know, this understanding that there's an assemblage there that is, you know, maybe temporary, but critical between these interactions and the sort of creating of these associations. Planning as a field is trying to grapple with what that might mean in our field, but it's really hard to think about, as Bob Beauregard has done, really, what these things are, what the sort of the built world, what the roles they really do play. It's still something that I will admit I'm struggling with, is how to really map this work out. So if those of you, you know, wanting to contribute have ideas for me, please keep your critical hat on and tell me what you think. So in terms of the actual mapping of these actors and how they associate, which only sometimes happens, right? Sometimes the theory is used in the sort of, the acknowledgement of sociology as the study of associations, not just between humans, but also between other groups. But sometimes there's actual mapping done that tries to connect these interactions with space. So here's a student group from Delft that was looking at how to better connect the city and the university, and understood that, like, water and green space and cars were all actors in this sort of association, and they tried to really map out what that looked like and then plan one green space with that in mind. Here's another example where there's a temple that sort of sits in a conflict zone, and these designers from the Office of Urban Terrain, tried to really understand, all right, so what are the different, in this case, not just nouns, but actually, you know, sort of the patterns of the discipline and the sort of conceptual realms that could be highlighted and brought out as a part of a planning process in the preservation of this temple, and which ones sort of breed more conflict and which ones might be conflict neutral as this temple is preserved. Just to give you examples of how this has looked. It's really still nascent in how it's taken on. But to bring us back to the project itself, which is where we'll stay for most of this now, although I did try to sort of map out each city. So as you see these maps, understand that's where I'm trying to go. Where is this happening? Well, these associations between housing, especially the unsubsidized preservation housing of the buildings themselves, not just the subsidy or the affordability of the transit systems and that sort of parallel understanding, and also of the retrofitting and what actors are at play here. In terms of the national scan, we were looking for three cases that might be comparable to one another and illustrative of different aspects or different challenges that come up. So we were looking at market strength, at the population size, the focus of the programs, the types of stakeholders involved. We ended up identifying a series of cities, some which were so unique that it seemed like they weren't necessarily useful, and some which the, in which the programs were unique but potentially replicable. So we ended up choosing Chicago, Washington, D.C., and Denver as cases that were illustrative in some specific way, but also potentially replicable in one part of their approach. So then I conducted a ridiculous amount of interviews with different types of actors, so city staff members, affordable housing developers, financial syndicate representatives, nonprofit service providers, and often the either regional advocacy groups if there were such things, and the greening advocacy groups or sort of technical service providers when applicable. Chicago is a really sort of uniquely instructive case because it's also the home of the MacArthur Foundation, which is very interested in this notion of unsubsidized affordable housing and how that might be preserved for all of the values we've been talking about today. So they've sort of adopted Chicago as their model. It's also a place that has high quality building stock, that's sort of worthy of preservation. And a really mixed marketplace. So their approach isn't one of just like, okay, every part of the city is experiencing this deep pressure, and we've got to move really fast. So they sort of use different approaches depending on where people are living. But there is a large amount of this. This is actually a graph of saying these 5 to 49 unit buildings and 2 to 4 unit buildings make up the majority of the housing stock, especially that's sort of affordable and unsubsidized in Chicago. And in this case, as I said, we have the MacArthur Foundation here, and they have been the shepherd for the creation of something called the Preservation Compact. It was originally sort of somewhere else, but it's come to the Chicago Community Investment Corporation, and it's where it's now been the sort of hub for about a decade. Elevate Energy is a major partner. They actually came out of the Center for Neighborhood Technology and are funded by a myriad of different public and private sources to do free energy audits. And that data is then channeled into a couple different sources and then represented at DePaul University's Institute for Housing Studies in an online portal that can be accessed by everybody in this preservation compact. Shriver Center is doing tenant advocacy, landlords are involved partially through their relationship with the city government. The city government has a troubled buildings initiative where any building that seems like it's being kind of forgotten by its landlord will then be sort of addressed. Interventions might take place to get the landlord back on track, and if that can't happen, then the building is sort of put into a system of potential like-minded developers that might work with the Preservation Compact in their goals, so that the building is in higher quality, up to higher quality standards, but also maintaining its status as unsubsidized affordable housing in the city. So the Preservation Compact, and the folks at the CIC that are really leading it are essential. And in fact, I'll show you a quote later, but the MacArthur Foundation contact there says that they are the special sauce of housing preservation work in this case, because you're getting a sort of deep connection and not only an advocacy role, but a sort of education role that is this connective tissue. They are the ones mediating all of these different groups to think and talk the same way. They work with groups like the Metropolitan Planning Council, who are thinking regionally about equity and TOD, less so about preservation of actual building stock. So they, everyone has an agenda, and the CIC really brings them together. Their Energy Savers program is another sort of separate entity within CIC, but they work incredibly well together to work with these small mom-and-pop landlords who don't necessarily have a big political agenda in terms of the unsubsidized affordable housing. They often live in the neighborhood and just it makes monetary sense to, you know, sort of be a part of these associations where they're getting tax breaks if they properly advocate for themselves, and they're housing their neighbors in a way that works for them. As I said, the housing stock is particularly just high quality in this in Chicago, and so they're able to do retrofits that make a lot of sense, and then typically the owner pays for a part of that, and the tenant pays for a part of that, and everybody wants to stay longer and feels healthier, so CIC spends a lot of time doing education and advocacy work and organizing work with these tenants. As I mentioned, the DePaul University Institute for Housing Studies actually plays a pretty critical role in managing this data portal. Data is such a challenge for these groups because the market does always sort of move faster in the sort of turnover of these unsubsidized units, and so the funding really coming from MacArthur, but now also from these public entities to support that data portal has been a critical piece, and especially in their association with Elevate Energy, this group that is doing the free energy audits and having a really finger on a pulse of exactly what this building stock looks like and the types of interventions in terms of retrofitting that might be useful to them. Stacy Young is the director of the Preservation Compact work for CIC, and she talks about the work that she's done, especially with utility companies, to get them to understand the role that unsubsidized affordable housing plays in the affordable housing world. Multifamily in general is not something that utilities have necessarily thought of as a part of the work that they might be giving some of their kind of required financing to. So she plays a huge role in being this sort of constant source of dialogue. She and Elevate in advocating for on-bill legislation that you know gets financing continually streaming into these projects in the hands of these landlords that are trying to do the right thing. Here's my attempt, the critique of myself at this point is that I can't figure out how to get the non-human actors really well represented. It's much easier to, because this is sort of traditional in the social sciences that we talk about the way all the humans interact, but getting the non-human actors on the table is really a challenge. My buddy in graphics and I are trying to force them in together, but there's some role that the market plays here, and in this case it's very mixed. Transit is actually not very highly valued as an association with opportunity in Chicago. Transit stops, it's a robust transit system, but transit stops don't mean opportunity for people. And so it's not seen as something worth really pushing. Interestingly, whereas, you know, we'll see in other cases, that's totally different. And it's a really large population size as well. And of course, the very, you know, kind of cold climate of Chicago does factor in as well. In D.C., the transit system is very much seen as a vital part of their economy and of this access to opportunity. The market is more stable. It's a smaller population. And what they really have is extremely unique in the D.C. area, besides a sort of long tradition of green building advocacy and policy, is actually a focus on tenant rights. And they have something called the Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act. So it's coming from a regulatory body and really informing the type of financing available and the type of advocacy necessary to get this work done. I'll talk more about that. The housing stock is of relatively high quality, and there are some very, very high capacity developers, including groups like the National Housing Trust, that have been able to pair themselves and make themselves really relevant to this tenant-led policy effort. So the advocacy world is incredibly robust. So this Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act really puts tenants at the forefront of the work. They are when a seller decides that they're going to put their housing up on the market, The tenants are required to be notified and then given a first right of refusal. They can organize and buy it cooperatively, and or they can associate themselves and sort of give their right to first right of refusal to a like-minded developer. And of course, this is an incredibly complicated thing, right? It's not an easy expectation to put on a group of lower income renters to say, you're going to organize and you're going to buy this very expensive property in a pretty stable marketplace, and it, you know, and it's going to be great. You're going to learn all these skills in the meantime, and you're going to flourish as your own, you know, cooperative landlord. So there's been an incredible amount of advocacy infrastructure that had to be built in place. So you have a group that's really focused on neighborhood housing and economic development that channels a lot of tenant advocacy groups together. And then you have a group, a housing association of nonprofit developers that is working more on the sort of technical side, helping and supporting the nonprofit developers that might then work with these tenant groups. And then all of these advocacy groups then work very hard to get unique sort of energy, not only technical providers, but financing available. This is another role where Enterprise Community Partners actually has a huge, their green building hub is in DC, so they're able to sort of really understand this connection between transit and green building and why one might raise money around that. So they really help with the housing trust fund. And then the DC government, because this is, you know, a mandated policy, really acknowledge that they have a role to play. These housing advocates are the critical sort of set of associations. They have working groups that are led by CNHCD, and they are constantly advocating for the reassertion of, you know, import for this housing trust fund. So it is actually per capita the largest housing trust fund in the country, very robust culturally, to the point where they were about to get a new mayor in when I was doing these interviews, and they were like so not concerned about what the new mayor thought about this process because it was going to happen either way. It was very robust kind of culture there, but of course one that is constantly having to reassert itself. Michael Bodakin, the executive director of the National Housing Trust, that does policy work in this arena across the country, but also is based in D.C. and a developer there, talks about this import of advocacy and how it allows for a change in conversation so that even those who aren't mission-driven understand and are fully educated and have sort of cultural incentives to do the right thing. And so he feels like this has created a culture in which smart people are also mission-driven people and vice versa, whereas, you know, he feels like in other parts of the country you don't necessarily get that alignment just kind of naturally. So, again, my attempt to bring in the non-human actors I'm struggling with, but there is a high level of connectivity. And that infrastructure is sort of, you know, historical there. The housing market is quite stable, but the pressures are not as great as we'll see in Denver. There is a real understanding and appreciation of preservation of these unsubsidized units as a way to get tenants to stay in place and to, you know, to resist gentrification and displacement. But there isn't, if you'll notice here, a real data hub. That is partially probably because there hasn't been the necessity with the Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act. The data is really coming directly mandated that the seller notify the tenant, right? And then everybody sort of gets in place. But it, in a perfect world, they would sort of be more robust in terms of the early warning system potential to plan ahead of time. They're always having to be reactive. And so instead they spend so much resources having that infrastructure in place so that when this first right of refusal comes up, they can act upon it. And in Denver, as I've said, the market is incredibly strong. Fast Tracks was a sort of a transit program that was, you know, put into place and well-funded, you know, voter approved, and slowly taking, you know, a real regional presence. And so housing advocates knew that they needed to really get a plan in place before Fast Tracks was fully implemented in order to have any hope of really preserving the existing, housing affordability in the city. So what they did was sort of using Chicago as a model, they formed something called Mile High Connects. They've got funding from the Ford Foundation, they've got funding from MacArthur, and the notion of preservation of affordable housing is key here, you know, the sort of linkage between this very robust transit system and the sort of sense that it's important to have green, affordable housing. They also have, actually, the transit-oriented development hub for Enterprise Community Partners is based in Denver. So again, you have this sort of local advocacy of a national group in place. And the problem, though, here was actually that they didn't have a lot of high-capacity developers and nonprofit developers that might have this sort of mission and capacity to really make use of the transit-oriented development fund that was set up to preserve affordable housing. So the Urban Land Conservancy became the de facto only receiver of the TOD fund as it was set up. So Mile High Connects, Enterprise Community Partners, and Urban Land Conservancy were really serving as a set of connective tissue. The Piton Foundation is one of many funders on the project, but they also have become the data portal. So they are, this site where you can go on and get a lot of indicator data about what's happening and how it's happening. You have sort of connections with lower capacity nonprofits, and there's small grant programs to try to really beef up other groups so that the Urban Land Conservancy isn't bearing the entire weight of the goals of this program. And then a lot of government groups that are serving as support systems and or financing for this effort, partially because we've had so many national funders, right, that came in and said this is important work to do. My caption's wrong there, but the problem in Denver has been that the market is going so fast and the quality of the housing stock that is available preservation of unsubsidized affordable housing is really pretty low. By the time it is, something that can be accessed through these TOD funds, it's not worth preserving. Additionally, it's complicated by the fact that the way the fund is set up, it's actually structured so that it makes the most sense to only preserve multifamily that's over 50 units. And there's just not much of that. Most of those are, like we've seen in these other cities, the stuff of unsubsidized affordable housing is often in the sort of 15 to 25 unit realm. And the way the fund has been set up, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. So they've actually, out of the, 45 projects that they've been able to fund, two of them have been actual preservation projects, which is a bit of an issue when the MacArthur Foundation is funding them at a pretty high level to do preservation work. And there's been this sort of disconnect between the kind of concept of preservation as just affordability and preservation as like the building stock and the sort of embodied energy valued there. Enterprise Community Partners, as I said, plays a huge local role. And here you have one of the sort of local leads there explaining how the location is a driving force. The sort of transit system and green building there is the sort of, the focus. And they've really kind of given up on trying to preserve much of the existing building stock itself because the market, they feel like, is just too strong. They've managed to actually, I think, quadruple the size of this fund and make it regionally accessible. So they now have gone past this real dependency on the Urban Land Conservancy. It's not yet time to change the actor network. The Urban Land Conservancy is definitely still the sort of critical central figure. Slowly they're building capacity in these other groups to actually serve in a much more robust way so that Mile High Connects is the sort of central figure. And the sort of rapid growth here is the sort of stated reason for why preservation of the stock itself is just really, at this point, they don't feel like it's an option at all. In terms of data, they have used the Piton data portal, but they've also created something called the Equity Atlas. This was originally also done by the Urban Land Conservancy because they had the sort of best mapping capabilities in-house. And I'm sure some of you are aware of equity atlases. They are, you know, used in cities across the country to sort of educate people and perpetuate the understanding of these, the way these things overlap and the spatial implications of different kind of issues in the sort of realms of equity. So in terms of what I've been able to sort of glean from these lessons is, as I've said, preservation itself, the definition of what preservation is and the why of why we do it, it's really still a sticky point in terms of translation. Housing advocates hear preservation of affordability and they think about subsidy. Whereas in the actually in the realm of if you're, you know, if you're looking at it from a more systems perspective about the, you know, the sort of preservation of that embodied energy and the sort of preservation of you know, the existing built form, unsubsidized affordable housing actually becomes, you know, maintains its place as a feasible option. So that language is still up for contention, especially in these strong market economies like Denver. As my my favorite quote from the, you know, the MacArthur contact was, you know, the connective tissue, these groups that are the network hub, are the special sauce of housing preservation and the funding of that and the sort of nurturing of those groups. It probably needs to be really sort of the robust focus when new cities are trying to adopt these models. Data continues to be a struggle. It's actually a role that a center like this one can really play in the kind of dissemination of you know, research, is these linkages in these portals that can be created where data is coming in from energy providers and, you know, those who are doing energy assessments. Actually, this is something that I think Dr. Blackhurst is doing some really interesting work on right now, is thinking about how we get that data, maybe even from tenants themselves, and how that data is then made useful in terms of, like, you know, action from the actor network perspective. The greening itself is typically coming and is funded and inspired and sort of monitored by Enterprise Partners Green Communities Initiative. And so really understanding what the different metrics are that might be sort of more appropriate at the local level, or how to keep pushing and working with Enterprise to understand the mechanisms they can use to make sure that green building strategies aren't just appropriated by developers and instead are kind of forwarding these initiatives. And again, the connective tissue, I think, is a critical thing for these understanding of how we balance priorities, because everybody in these actor networks still comes either as a housing advocate who cares about equity issues, or as a green building advocate who cares about, you know, climate change, or as a transit advocate. So we, you know, getting past just language barriers and starting to educate one another, figuring out what that dialogue looks like, is pretty important. There's my quote from Alison Clark on the secret sauce of preservation. And one last group that I'll sort of close with that's doing interesting work, creating network hubs at the national level now, is this group Energy Efficiency for All. It is a partnership that actually the National Housing Trust has been a major part of, along with, let me see if I can get all my partners correct, the Energy Foundation, Elevate Energy, our friend from Chicago, National Housing Trust, and the National Resources Defense Council. They've been working together to make real change in states across, I think they're in 20 states now across the country, trying to educate state governments on the value of greening multifamily housing in these ways that we've been discussing, especially that unsubsidized affordable housing, but all types of multifamily housing, because as we heard from Stacey Young in Chicago, utilities often feel that, you know, they're done when they sort of green anything. And so the role that this unsubsidized affordable housing plays and the mechanisms that it might be kind of funded are really something that, that we're starting to look at nationally, which I think is really exciting. Thanks for listening. I would love feedback. And Mike, if you're willing to talk about your work at all, that would be really great.
Sure, I'm happy to talk a bit about the Austin project that that Barbara profiled. We were interested in same housing stock, unsubsidized housing stock. We were interested in whether or not we could find non-subsidy incentives that would, let me back up. So there's a tremendous amount of growth in Austin. There's a lot of financial opportunity for private property owners to sell, and that creates a lot of stress for the particular, for low-income householders. If the stock is going to remain unsubsidized, are there other incentives that, that we could identify that would really make sense? So tax breaks, there's a tremendous amount of energy efficiency incentives. The city and the county talked about incentives for just conventional redevelopment. So could we package enough incentives such that it would beat back the financial opportunity that the private owner otherwise might face? Does that make sense? So if you're thinking about selling, you're going to sell in 1, 2, 3, 5 years, thinking about how much money you might make, could we beat that back with some incentives that still keep it unsubsidized through either existing or new financial instruments?
Would you also talk about the work you're dipping your toe into now in
Sure.
terms of the data collection, resident-led?
Yeah, I really enjoy thinking about how homeowners in particular make energy technology choices. I was telling this smaller audience here earlier and how that affects energy use. The challenge is always getting that data. It's very diffuse. It's expensive to get an energy audit together. Those data are often stuffed into a report or an email and never see the light of day and are kind of restricted from real high-value uses like research and policy making. So we're trying to find some funds to develop technology to use your smartphone to do an energy audit. The goal would be as a typical homeowner could do an energy audit for free in about 20 minutes. So you'd go and run around your house, take pictures of appliances, and this would be photo recognized on a server. You could rent out the infrared camera at the library and stream that information back to a server. Or if you had a smart thermostat, you could stream that information to the server. And then all that data are processed and give you some recommendations, and you have the option of publishing that data for others to use. Right? So if any of you are interested in something like that and could connect me to potential sponsors of research, I'd really appreciate it. But we're trying to get some work going along those lines. Okay.
Questions or comments?
Two questions. One, does the Carnegie Library have infrared cameras?
I think they may.
We have spec monitors.
Spec ones.
I'm not aware
of
any infrared, but we do have the spec ones for people to gather data on their indoor air quality.
Okay. And then related to your great presentation, how are, if it's either a mission-driven developer or nonprofit coming in, how are they financing the acquisition? And I'm assuming there has to be some recapitalization of the properties because they're naturally affordable for a reason. They're in bad shape, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's the existing property owner, again, what's the financing, be it conventional, unconventional debt, or other sources or other incentives?
Mm-hmm. It varies. Of course, wildly. Often in the sort of new purchase and acquisition, which is most typically done in DC, right, because of this Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act, the city government has some funding available for acquisition that they is set up in a way that you could, as a tenant association, access it itself, although typically what they do is then, you know, set you up, as I said, with a developer. The fund in place there is actually, there is a TOD fund that was less successful but still exists, and a housing fund, but those are all used for acquisition. They're moving now to try to think about how to especially the advocates, the housing advocates that are trying to work with the tenants and these lower, the smaller capacity developers, to think through how to work in a bit more robust financial model that includes future renovations required, because of course often the renovations up front are just one phase of, you know, because some things aren't ready for a replacement right away, but they very well may be in 10 years. And so understanding how to give groups the capacity. I mean, the reason that our public housing is in such bad shape is we've never been very good at thinking about maintenance and the financing of that maintenance. And so they're trying, at least in D.C., to really make a sophisticated set of judgment calls as they're allocating those sources of funds to make sure that you are not only safe for the first phase of rehab, but that actually you can kind of last beyond. You're not crippled by the next thing that is in need of restoration.
Do those funds typically come with affordability covenants or restrictions?
Yes, not always. So in Chicago, the funds are, there's this sort of awareness and understanding about the importance of, affordability, and they are asked to report in a pretty consistent basis on what level of affordability they're reaching, but the mandates aren't very strong there. So you could flip after, I can't remember, but I think it's a 10-year period. So you could flip your unit. They're not finding that's really typically the case because of the culture they're perpetuating, but it's not sort of set up in the financing itself. Yeah.
Well, thank you for this very interesting and promising. I'm thinking about your D.C. case mm-hmm. in particular and the role of transit in that. I read recently the study reported in the Washington Post about what's happening along the transit lines, where the population is becoming whiter, younger, more professional, and the traditional patrons of public transit are being moved further and further from the metro stops, which suggests that there's some limits to what's being done in terms of the kind of preservation model that you're describing here.
The most successful cases seem to be those, because the market is pretty stable and I think increasingly strong there, are those that are not only done through the TOPA, the Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act, but then paired with very high capacity developers like National Housing Trust, who then brings on a mission-based developer with major financing capabilities like Jonathan Rose development. So the project I showed, Channel Square, if I can get back to it, whoopsie, I've messed myself up now, is one, we saw this pretty robust solar array there, right? Like that project was incredibly complex to finance and would have never been something that even a sort of lower capacity developer with this robust housing trust fund could have implemented. So it required not only the sort of national capacity wherewithal of the National Housing Trust, but also the sort of, capital of a group like Rose Development. So although the infrastructure is in place, you're right, getting to those really prime pieces of property that are right along transit corridors still requires national level funding and a mission-based developer that comes in. Yeah.
This is on the borders of your research, so if you just say it's not relevant, but in your research of the cities that you listed, did you find any cases in which an advocacy network existed outside of city boundaries, so in near, outlying suburban areas, and what cities were those? I'd be interested in learning.
Yeah. So I only looked deeply at these three cities, but the one that has the sort of strongest advocacy network outside the boundaries is this Metropolitan Planning Council group, it was interesting how, although they definitely described themselves as a part of this preservation compact, they were kind of seen as an outsider even, because a lot of the people working in it were very Chicago sort of focused, whereas their interest was more in pairing equity issues and transit locations together, less on the sort of greening, and so new development was a much bigger focus in these outlying areas, and so it was interesting how they were even perceived to be a bit of an outsider, but also still an essential part of the sort of tissue. Yeah.
Did I hear you right that in Chicago you said the landlord and the tenant can each pay a portion of the retrofit?
They each benefit from, they each pay a portion of the utilities. So no, the tenants are not absorbing the costs of. They may be, but the thought is that they are, because typically in Chicago, the structure is that the tenant pays 50% and the landlord pays 50% of energy costs. They both get a pretty dramatic benefit, and Chicago's seeing reductions in utility costs up to like 45%. Per month, when these retrofits are in place, so it's dramatic for everybody when it's done well.
Yeah. I wonder if you ever came across in any of the cities you looked at, or if you're considering in Austin, community land trusts as a way to get tenants and bottom up buy-in on stuff, and then to preserve that affordability piece of it over the very, very long term.
Yeah. It's a great question. The community land trust model is something that Denver is trying to figure out. You know, Urban Land Conservancy sort of functions in a sort of hybrid capacity, but isn't a sort of pure community land trust model. Austin's definitely interested in that. I mean, it's still really a nascent conversation. They've sort of recognized that they have a problem, but they haven't quite gotten to the level of, forming actual networks. They're sort of in those interior stages, but they do have the mechanism in place for a community land trust to be functional. They've never really figured out how to make it work, but technically it's there. But it's more of like an imagination limitation at the moment.
I think they have a small land bank for single family only. Do they know
it's
possible?
It's supposed to be available for use in by the community housing development organizations to think in a way of at least about like lower density multifamily housing, but it's never been used that way. Yeah.
I have two questions. So one is in your presentation, you were use the word preservation. Are you referring to historic preservation or preservation of affordable housing?
That's part of the challenge, right? So the focus of this study was to think about the preservation of unsubsidized building stock, right? So housing that was typically older, worthy of retrofitting, but needed to stay affordable. So not only the preservation of the building itself, but also of its affordability. Without subsidy, which is, because subsidy goes away, right? Subsidy is sort of its own bear. But in Denver, in particular, they were using the same words and acting as though they were using them in the same context, but they often only meant the preservation of affordability. They just had given up on the housing stock as a part of that conversation.
And then my second question is, you said that there was a little bit of, a struggle to collect timely data.
Mm-hmm.
I work in the north side and I work with the community groups, and I've been trying to collect data about vacant buildings, but the community groups have been have pushed back strongly because of privacy concerns. Like, they are worried about, developers coming in and starting to flip houses or whatever. So is that one of the major issues, or are there lots of other issues that make it hard?
Well, it's one of the reasons that these hubs are so important is often the data portals have a portion of them that are not available publicly. So everybody that's in this hub and associated with these networks are have access to that data, but it is not available to those who haven't kind of become a part of the actor network because of the ability to use that in just a sort of purely market-driven way. It's a major problem, which is why a pretty robust infrastructure has to be put into place if you want to kind of keep it useful.
Pittsburgh is quite different in that our house, we have a tremendously high, much higher vacancy rate, abandonment rate than these other cities, where there's a lot of pressure for development, a lot of growth in the real estate market. And that will happen here, but I don't see the kind of abandonment rate in some cities.
Yeah, Chicago has some of that. It's really mixed, I think, which is why this Troubled Buildings Initiative has been driven by the city, so that buildings that have really become a problem for neighbors have or, you know, for the tenants themselves to become unsafe, there's a structure in place to sort of either get those landlords on board or by eminent domain actually take them back and put them in the hands of people who will kind of further their affordability. Yeah.
Mike, could you say what you said again? I couldn't hear you.
Oh, I just said that having, well, I think Pittsburgh's abandonment rate is probably a bit higher. And I guess it's interesting that, you know, I'm hearing from you that there's a lot of interest in repurposing those properties in Chicago, whereas there's a real concern about repurposing those properties here on the north side. So I'd love to hear more about why they're so different. But I suspect that we have a much higher abandonment rate than the other cities.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked at, across these municipalities, for the presence or absence of a rental registry?
Mm-hmm.
For local landlords, and what the, if so, what the impact of the institution of that policy has over time.
Mm-hmm.
I am on the Pittsburgh City Council, and I represent some very high demand housing markets.
Yeah.
And we recently enacted rental registry legislation, but we haven't actually started implementing it. And in the very highly densely populated, zero vacancy neighborhoods that I represent, I have a lot of small landlords
mm-hmm.
who are very discouraged.
Yeah.
And I have to go to community meetings and say, please don't sell.
Right.
Please stop, because they're the only affordable landlords.
Right. Right.
And they might have five properties, they have grandma's property, they have their aunt's property.
Right.
They're probably renting family members, mm-hmm. but it's the only affordable housing in my city council.
Yeah.
So I'd be really interested to see how this varies.
Yeah. Yeah, rental registries didn't seem to be, it's not something that I made sure I understood the presence of or not, but they didn't come up very often. So that's a really interesting question. I'm trying to think back on the interviews.
They're fairly
new. You know, yeah.
Not in metropolitan areas, so I'm wondering what, if there's anyone looking at data
mm-hmm.
to see what impact they've had across these different kinds of housing forms and ownership structures,
yeah.
especially.
Yeah, that's a question I can actually ask of the Enterprise Community Partners folks, because I'm sure that they are up to date. Yeah, if you have cards, so I'll give you one, and I'll introduce you.
We're still working on the policy, and I would love to see these kinds of incentives are brilliant.
Yeah.
So that's exactly the kind of stuff I've been struggling to find okay. that would encourage and support and embrace these smaller landholders and to get them to not sell to flippers, because I've got flippers knocking on the door.
Sure, right, so, right.
Yeah, I think that we own a property in Pittsburgh. We're landlords as well, and it's a one unit in Bloomfield. I think the rental registry that's currently on the books.
We're talking about Bloomfield. That's exactly what I was talking about, yeah.
The one that's on the books does feel very punitive. So can you couple that with some incentives so that these smaller actors don't feel that punitive sense.
A grace period, yeah. Lower costs.
Exactly, if they want to retrofit something,
they get
some non-monetary incentives when they apply for a permit, you know, those sorts of things. And I think there's lots of opportunities to make sure that they feel like the city's looking out for that aspect of, you know, that dimension of the rental market.
A grant program to help come up to code. I mean, these are, again,
people
who haven't looked at property in 30 years. You know, they live right around the corner,
right.
but they haven't invested in it.
Right. Well, so yeah, I'll introduce you to not only the Enterprise Community Partners folks, but also Elevate Energy. They're working nationally now and may really be useful in thinking through what those funding mechanisms could be and also what those sort of monitoring in a positive way might be.
Here's another thought, is that Duquesne Light and People's Gas are having a tough time filling all their energy incentives
mm-hmm.
To meet regulatory requirements. So is there a partnership with them where you can provide some incentives that are basically the only cost of the city's administrative costs? You're providing these energy retrofits that are already paid for right at the state level or the utility level, and just connecting the dots in that regard.
Yeah, I'm
really impressed by the savings that they're seeing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's good news, you know, for landlords that want to do the right thing but don't know how, you know, financially to make it work. I was trying to, my internet is sort of being funny again, but it's possible that energy efficiency for all is in Pennsylvania now.
I think
they might be. I mean, it's very new work, but that they you may have an infrastructure already in place at the state level to make an argument for those resources to be properly allocated.
And as a follow-up, because you think of now advocates, I mean, the strongest advocates we have for affordability in Pittsburgh is our kind of Pittsburgh United Alliance between the environmental organizations, the labor union, the ones who are doing the Fight for 15, et cetera, and they're very strong. We're one of the strongest cities across the country that advocacy. So I'm very eager to see if they've seen this work as well. So I'm going to share with them.
The work of the sort of partnership for working families models where you're getting labor union and environmental groups together are those community benefit agreement models are really, really powerful and actually would be a totally great infrastructure to think through this type of thing.
What's interesting about this conversation is that, you know, a lot of the housing stock that, at least in Austin, that is being studied, was built when Pittsburgh had its major decline. So a lot of, I suspect, a disproportionate of our unsubsidized rental market is just a single family home, because we kind of missed out on that period of growth that characterizes the kind of building stock that you're studying.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be a lot of unique barriers and opportunities here.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about building health. Are there any abatement programs aimed at the housing that is affordable by virtue of its questionable quality?
Absolutely. Yeah, lead abatement is, part and parcel. I think it's something, I might be wrong, but that Elevate Energy is actually really, they're doing as a part of their sort of retrofitting, because it just makes sense when you're, looking at new windows and all of that. It's become, the nice part about lead abatement is it's something that we've kind of acknowledged at the policy level is a really important thing, and, federal money is coming in to do it. So weatherization programs, I think, are a really nice ally. And National Housing Trust in particular, not only as a developer but also as a researcher, has been able to do some pretty robust data collection around health outcomes of these retrofits. So they actually have some really good numbers on what that looks like for the residents themselves.
I wanted to, express a bit of skepticism and ask how landlords, how receptive they are and how responsive they are to the incentives, because I came out of working in a community group, and in our particular neighborhood, most of the natural affordable housing, REIT slumlords, bought the houses in the 80s when we lost 180,000 jobs in 18 months, and so the land values plummeted because people were leaving, right? So you had a building that was in pretty good shape, but because the land value was so low, you're able to pick it up for 20 grand cash, right? No debt. And then they're just riding that building until it literally falls apart. And that's their business model. For better or for worse, that's paying for their kids to go to college, right? That's a really different business model than reinvesting in a building and having to figure out BVI, God help us, So how do you get a landlord to fundamentally shift their business model?
I think that is why in the city of Chicago, where this is also very much an issue, the city has had to become involved in actually thinking through structures to say, like, all right, if you won't come on board, then we're going to take this from you.
They're using eminent domain on occupies.
I think they're only moderately occupied for the most part, but it's a lot of the sort of absentee landlords that have really given up, right? They're at the end of that line, and they've just stopped caring at all about the building. Sometimes it's, it was in receivership, and it's not even in hands of anyone who even sort of knows that the building exists.
Okay.
And so sometimes it's just like following the paper trail till you get to the person or the bank who accidentally owns this thing and sort of saying like, okay, we'd like it back now. Someone would like to make use of the structure. Sometimes it is a landlord who's just, it's no longer livable.
I think that's a remarkable political environment, given Councilwoman well knows the serious skepticism and serious opposition when we're passing a land bank law, which was not even really contemplating taking occupied at all.
Right. It is definitely, I think, something that the city does not take, you know, and does not do very lightly. You know, they were even really, as I interviewed them, that you could tell they were sort of, like, uncomfortable about talking. You know, it was like the quiet program. So it's definitely something that that I think they, you know, experience daily controversy over, and it plays a small role in this program. I don't think it's used very often, but it is a nice hammer to have, at least as a threat, if nothing else, for landlords to sort of buck up. And then the nice part is that you do have this advocacy community of, you know, where there are like-minded people who can kind of say, you know what, I felt like this was a ridiculous thing too, but look, I'm saving 45%, you know, percent, and so it makes monetary sense for me, and people, you know, there is some other peers that can convince you that actually this might not be such a bad strategy after all, especially if you're otherwise at risk of losing your property.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
I think in response to the landlord question, and it's also sort of a question of something we're facing in Pittsburgh, how do you move a camp? Landlords that don't want to move, I think it's going to be community groups that are going to end up pushing them in the right direction or community mobilization. And something we haven't talked about in this discussion here is about transit. I mean, in Pittsburgh, my feeling is that we do have, you know, the market in Pittsburgh is really all over the place, and we've got some really hot communities, and we've got some really not hot at all communities. And one thing that's driving development is, at least in my opinion, is our transit accessibility. So we're seeing major development along major transit corridors, and no development in part because some of those areas where there's a lot of natural affordable housing are also largely depopulated, or at least traditionally have been largely depopulated. How do we, this is more of just on a soapbox, but how do we make that balance, and where do we push for more affordable housing along, you know, major transit corridors to ensure that people can stay there, either in subsidized or unsubsidized housing?
Right. Yeah.
Port Authority and the city just recently completed a study of homeless. So some of the weird things that we heard in that were like, I mean, does the neighborhood really want to see an improvement in the station? It's like, okay, well, these are things that are going to make your lives better, is improving safety, and it's going to look nicer, it's going to be a lot safer, it's not a very, and usability of the station out of very good transit, it's already got really good transit service at it, but is that going to drive me out of my home because of that? So I'm really interested in this idea of that there are different definitions of preservation, that this would have been a good thought to have in mind firsthand, to ask them, well, how do you feel about preservation? Is it preserving my rent? My rent's not going to go up, or is it really about the community? Is it you're not going to tear down this building that means a lot to me?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I mean, different. Is it okay that different communities define that differently?
Yeah,
sure.
It's much more, I think, about the ability to understand and speak the same language, right? So you need these groups that are a bit of like code switchers, right? That are sort of like, okay, I hear you're using preservation in this way, and you're using it in this other way, and actually that's okay, right? But let's think about practice and, you know, how this really does, how we get to some mutual understanding and mutual action, right? But yeah, it seems totally okay. Even the MacArthur Foundation, who, you know, funded preservation work that's actually preserving something else, is still sort of acknowledges that there's space for that. Okay, well, thanks so much for having me.